Okay, so, Venerable Bhikshu, where...
Well, actually, Kusala.
Okay.
Because now, let me explain that, too, okay. for you. So my name is Venerable Kusala Bhikshu. I was given the name Kusala as my Buddhist name, and which means skillful or wholesome, which is something I aspire to. But everybody wanted to have me have a last name, because if they put an article in, they need, well, what's your last name? What's your last name? So I came up with Bhikshu. So Bhikshu means monk. So it's Kusala the monk, skillful monk. So you can just call me skillful.
I love that.
Or how about Kusala?
Wonderful. Sure. Okay, so Kusala.
Perfect.
When and where were you born?
I was born Iowa City, Iowa, 1949.
Okay, and were your family religious?
They were. They were religious Lutherans and the conservative Lutherans. I think the Missouri Senate or something like that. And yeah, so I went to church and was baptized and did all the things that we're supposed to do when you're a kid. Yeah.
And so you weren't drawn to that religion. Why were you drawn to Buddhism and to meditation?
Yeah, well, it's a long story, but to make it short, I was a Lutheran because my parents were Lutheran, and then my parents got divorced when I was 11, and my mother was always non-religious. She turned out to be the religion of her husband. She was married twice, started as a Lutheran, ended up as an Episcopalian. But she never told us we needed to be religious, and so I was a Lutheran until the divorce, and then I was sort of like, I was 12, and I was sort of like nothing. And then I went to high school, and I decided to be an agnostic. I decided to maybe believe in something, but not define it or know what it was. And that worked fine for a long time, because it was in the 60s, and it was important to question all authority and not trust anyone over 30. So that's how we did that. So then I turned 30. So I did exactly what I was hoping would never happen, and I did. And then I said, well, you know, I'll be dead soon because people over 30 die quickly. So let me find a religion so I can die well, because people with religion seem to die well. And so I bought a book by Houston Smith, World Religions. And in that book was a chapter on Buddhism. I read that twice, and I said, I'm going to be a Buddhist. So I got a phone book when we used to have phone books, and went to the Yellow Pages and found this place, and started to come here in 1979 to learn how to meditate. So it wasn't I wasn't divinely inspired. It was just a real practical choice of wanting to die well.
Wonderful. This is great. One thing I will ask is that you slow down a little bit because we're Italian readers.
Oh, that's right. So we have maybe non-English speakers listening, so I will speak more slowly.
That's great. Thank you so much, but otherwise this is perfect.
Good.
Awesome. So you began meditating, and then how did you go from that to this? Yes.
Okay. I began meditating in 1979. How's that good?
That's, yeah.
And I found it to be very difficult and caused me to have a lot of suffering. Because in the beginning of a meditation practice, what seems to occur is a purification or a purging of subconscious stuff that becomes conscious. So you're sitting in the meditation hall, and all of a sudden you're thinking about something that happened 24 years ago and how unskillful you were, and would everybody forgive you? And then the gong rang, and that lasted for like 2 years. So there was 2 years of purging that occurred. Then I started to settle. What they say about meditation is like having a glass of muddy water, and you put the glass and let it sit, and all the mud goes to the bottom and the water becomes clear again. So I sat long enough for it to become clear again after all the mud and the purging was over. And then I decided that I really wanted to learn more about Buddhism. So I found a teacher, Dr. Ratanasara, who became my primary Dharma teacher for 16 years. And he was a Theravada elder from Sri Lanka. So I learned Buddhism in a very early Buddhist way called the Theravada. And at some point in my taking classes and getting eventually a bachelor's in Buddhist studies, my teacher said to me, well, Kusala. You've never been married, and your job is okay, but it's really not much of a career. Have you ever thought about becoming a monk? And I said, no, I never have thought about becoming a monk. But then I reflected on this might be an opportunity to do something that I really like to do, that's something that I have passion for. And so I started the ordination process. And in 1993, I became a postulant. I took the 8 precepts, preparing to become a novice monk. I held those precepts for 1 year, and then I went through the ordination of becoming a novice monk in 1994, where we get 10 precepts. I held those precepts for 2 years, and then my teachers asked me if I wanted to continue and become fully ordained, and I said yes, and then I received like over 300 precepts and became a monk, and then I held those for 5 years as my apprenticeship, and after 5 years, I was given permission to either start my own center, have my own students, or live here and continue my work. And they gave me a red robe, which signifies I am free to leave or to stay. And that was 1999.
Very good. how has Buddhism in America changed over that period? It seems that Buddhism is becoming more popular here. Is that the case? And if so, why?
Yes, I think what we're finding now with Buddhism in America is that we have much better scholarship and far better books to read. In the 60s and 70s, we had a lot of the Pali Text Society out of England. They were Protestants who translated the Pali Text into English using almost New Testament language to explain Buddhism. It didn't work quite as well. In the 70s, we had a lot of homegrown Buddhists who became monks or nuns, who then became scholars and who wrote books, including American culture and American understanding. We also had temples and universities. They became available to Westerners, especially in the West Coast and the East Coast, who wanted to study Buddhism with teachers not necessarily from Asia, but from America. And that really got the ball rolling, because American Buddhism is going to be much different than European Buddhism or Asian Buddhism. It is going to have its own flavor and its own way of looking at the Dharma, which would be culturally appropriate. So is it popular? It actually is popular, and more popular perhaps than it has been. We have some wonderful PR people like the Dalai Lama. He's like the best. We have Thich Nhat Hanh. We have other people who talk about Buddhism, and people from around the world can appreciate what they say and how they say that, or how they say it. So it really is nice to understand. Now, one of the ways I know Buddhism is getting more popular is because now we have jokes about Buddhism, we have clothing with the Buddha on it, which is not maybe religious appropriate, but it happens anyway. And in some cases, people criticize Buddhism. But that means that it's become normal. Buddhism has become normal in America because all those things are happening now.
And what is it, do you think, that is about Buddhism that appeals to people as opposed to any other religion?
I think for me, the thing that appealed most was the fact that it was non-theistic. It's not atheistic. Some people have a misconception that we don't believe in God. But that's not the point. The point of Buddhism is, why do we suffer and how do we end our suffering? And so far in the history of the world, no God or gods have stepped forward and said, I will end human suffering. So Siddhartha, who later became the Buddha, decided to see if he could do it himself, and he did. So it's a very secular humanistic approach to suffering in the world. We don't blame God for the suffering, but we don't ask God to end our suffering either. We look to the Dharma for that. the teachings of the Buddha.
Very good. Do you think there are misconceptions about Buddhism? Is it sort of seen as a little new age by people in the West?
I think in the beginning it was made new age. There was somebody called Madame Blavatsky, Colonel Olcott, the theosophists, the ascended masters, golden tablets. Buddhism sort of creeped in there somehow. There's a lot of history in Buddhism, at least in the West, Europe and America, about people who were sort of new agey before it was even a word. And I think as time has gone on, it's become four things. Now, the first thing it's become a credible religion for most. The second thing it's become a very interesting philosophy for some. The third thing it's become is a therapy. You have a whole movement of Vipassana people who are using it to end their suffering, but they're secular Buddhists, not religious Buddhists. And last but not least, it's become a lifestyle for some. All cotton, vegetarian, go see the Dalai Lama, kindness is their motto. So it's looked at in a variety of ways. But each of those ways is just another facet, I think, of the jewel of Buddhism, the gem of Buddhism.
And how do you feel about it becoming very popularized? Like you said, everywhere you go, you see the Buddha statues, you see it on clothes, on shoes, on jewelry. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's just a matter of time till that falls away. No fads, no flavor of the week or the month lasts very long. So Buddhism may be the in religion now, but it'll just be one of the other religions later.
Okay, very good. Are there rules and restrictions to Buddhism? You mentioned wearing cotton, not eating meat. Are these rules that Buddhists have to follow?
No. In fact, there was a lot of confusion in that. The Buddha was a meat eater. He was a beggar. So he ate what was offered to him. So he ate meat. But there are a lot of Buddhists who are vegetarian and don't eat meat. And sometimes they think they're better Buddhists than the ones that do eat meat. They're probably not, but they may be reducing suffering by not eating meat. Cotton, no. There's no particular way to dress, though some people wear the malas, the beads around their neck as a sign of being a Buddha. Some people get the Buddha tattooed on their arm or their back. Actually, for a Buddhist, if you want to identify and feel like you're doing Buddhist work or living a Buddhist lifestyle, the Dalai Lama said, "My religion is kindness." So if people are kind, they're representing Buddhism in a good way.
So if you want to become a Buddhist, you just have to decide, I'm a Buddhist?
If you want to become an official Buddhist, no, there's a ceremony. It's called Refuges and Precepts. So to become an official Buddhist at our center here, we have a certificate suitable for framing. You get a religious name. You take refuge in the Triple Gem. You take refuge in the Buddha as a world teacher. You take refuge in his teachings as the salvation you're looking for from suffering. And you take refuge in the monks and nuns as a living example of people on the path trying to achieve nirvana in this very lifetime. The five precepts that one takes to become an official Buddhist are, I will practice not taking life. I will practice not taking what is not given. I will practice not indulging in sexual misconduct. I will practice not to speak unskillfully. I will practice not to consume intoxicants. So the reason I use the word practice is because these are not commandments. This is a training that you're putting yourself through. And if you succeed in training yourself in this way, you will reduce your suffering dramatically.
Wow, amazing. Now, this is something I've always wondered. Do you think that if Buddhism was the main religion of the world, that the world would be a better place because of the belief in reincarnation? Do you think there would be less prejudice and racism because you would look at other people as being absolutely equal? I mean, you can come back as any member of any group on our planet.
No. Buddhism is not the best religion. Buddhism is only the best religion for Buddhists. The diversity of humankind requires more than one religion, it seems to me. And we have plenty of religions, and they all work. They all do what they're supposed to do. Buddhism is the religion of suffering and the end of suffering. So we don't necessarily create a relationship with God or have an eternal life ever after. And in most cases, Buddhism doesn't have reincarnation. Buddhism has rebirth. And the difference between reincarnation and rebirth is this. Reincarnation requires a soul. And the Buddha was hesitant in saying that we are a soul. He said, you might have one, but that's not who you really are. So a lot of Buddhists are trying to figure out who they really are, and they keep coming to a place of emptiness, empty of independent existence. Now, if you understand what that means, it means we do not all need to be in the same religion to be connected. We, as humans and trees and cats and dogs and all the other things on earth, are always interconnected and interdependent. We can never be separate from that. What makes us separate is our ego and our sense of self, which is necessary to live in a very complicated world. So people, oftentimes when I'm doing interreligious work, say, well, it's nice that we're all one. And I say to them, I'm not one, I'm one of the many, and we're all connected.
So are you saying that all religions are equally valid? And if so, are all truths equally valid?
I would say all religions work. At some level, they all work. Truth, being relative, is dependent on time and place and person thinking about it. Is there an ultimate truth? Well, even the ultimate truths seem to be a bit different. For instance, some people in Christianity might feel God is the ultimate truth. In Mahayana Buddhism, they might say emptiness is the ultimate truth. In Theravada Buddhism, they might say nirvana is the ultimate truth. Now, how to make sense of all that diversity? The Buddha said, our entire world exists in this fathom-long body. So what is our truth? That's the most important thing.
Wonderful. That's amazing. So tell us about the center here. If people come to LA, can they come
Yes. Our little modest, humble center was founded in 1970 by Venerable Thich Thien Nhan, a Vietnamese monk who was teaching at UCLA, teaching Eastern philosophy and Buddhism. Some of his students at UCLA suggested to him to start a center so they could go deeper into training. This was the first house he bought. He bought this house in 1970 and ended up buying the next house and the next house and the next house for his students to live in so they could train with him. And everything was working fine until 1980, and then he died. And that seems to be the bug in the oil or the ointment, that everybody dies, and it's usually not at the right time. So there was an upheaval and who's going to take over and what direction should we go in and blah, blah, blah. And it ended up with Reverend Karuna Dharma being the next leader, the abbess of the center in 1980. And she just passed away a couple years ago. So she was the abbess for a very long time. The direction she wanted to go in was one of teaching and ordaining and bringing the Dharma and Buddhism to the Los Angeles area. We have a residential program here. We have altogether five houses and people living in all of them, and they pay rent. Now, I think the founder was very smart in realizing that Americans coming to Buddhism probably wouldn't support the center in an appropriate way out of ignorance, not because they didn't want to. The Asian centers are well supported and funded by their communities, and we exist because people live here and pay rent. Now, we have a variety of animals, as you've seen. We have cats, and we used to have dogs, and we used to have birds, and we have fish. And it is said that if a cat or a dog or a bird or a fish sees the image of the Buddha, or hears the chanting of the monks, or smells the incense burning in the zendo, that it plants a seed and they will be reborn as a human. We are counting on that, so when all these little creatures who have lived here turn out to be humans, we're going to invite them to live here and pay rent.
That's wonderful. And so if people come by, can they meditate here? You have meditation groups?
We do. Well, we have a fixed schedule. Oftentimes the door is locked because we live in an urban area. But we have a Sunday service from 11 to 12. Right now we have meditation in the evening on Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday from 7:30 to 8:30. And often there are special events occurring here. For instance, the first Saturday of each month we have a morning retreat from 10 until noon, and then we share food after that. So there are opportunities, and it would be best to check our website to see what's available. That is www.ibmc.info.
Very good. And who comes here now? What are they looking for? What do they want to experience?
Everybody that comes here is looking for something unique to them. So it's really hard to give, everybody's here because of this or because of that. Everybody's here because they feel something's missing in their life. And if you talk to them, they would tell you what it is, or maybe, you know, generally speak about it, but maybe not know it. And each person would have something different that they want to find or resolve or grow with. And so it's interesting. Sometimes in the Christian tradition, you have the shepherd and the flock. In the Buddhist tradition, we have cats. So we sit alone together. Just like cats, if you see them, they'll always have space between themselves. And they'll be sitting together, but they'll be sitting together alone. So Buddhism is sort of like that.
And what is the benefit of meditation just for anyone?
Well, the benefit of meditation is clarity and kindness. It's a cultivation of the mind. It's bringing it, it's slowing it down and making it a bit more transparent. When one meditates for a series of months or years, one starts to see that the mind is not the master, but the mind is a tool that we use. The self is a tool that we use to make our way through this very complicated world. For me, I look at meditation as allowing me to see myself in a much different way and see how I'm connected to a variety of things.
And you mentioned that you're in an urban setting here. So what is the contrast between the outside world, outside of the center, and then within the center?
Yes.
How does one...
The center almost seems like a refuge. We have drugs and graffiti and gangs and gunshots and a variety of things that are found in every urban center. And yet we have this parcel of land with four houses side by side and fenced in, and it's grass, and we have trees, and we have cats, and we have a koi pond and a big bell tower. And it's a nice place to come and sort of come and relax in the serenity of the surroundings. When I go out into the world and maybe go someplace to eat or just walk down the street to the store, yeah, the chaos of Vermont Avenue with its 10,000 cars and the helicopters and the sirens and people shoulder to shoulder, I say to myself, I'm so lucky I live at a meditation center and can take refuge there daily.
Wonderful. And a final question, if you can tell me briefly what a typical day in your life is like.
You know, this is going to sound really weird, but there is no typical day. Every day is different. Today you're here. And it's so there is no routine that I can get into. There's no habit pattern that I can create for myself. Every day is the first day.
But is there a particular time you wake up?
It varies. Sometimes I'm up at 3 a.m. Sometimes at 8. It depends what I have to do. What kind of focus I'm. I've just finished a website that I've been working on for 2 weeks, and I would get up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning because it's the most quiet time in the urban setting, and work on that website. And I work on it for 5, 6, 7 hours straight, and finally got it posted. And it's so satisfying, but I get myself into this sort of obsessive state of total commitment to get it done, and so. It varies day to day and week to week when I get up, what I need to do. Every day is the first day, which may sound really exciting, but with a regular routine, you can sort of sleepwalk through it sometimes and not pay attention. But if the first day is every day, then you have to be awake the whole day.
But you must have do some things routinely. For example, feed the cats, I imagine.
Well, yes, we have that. Yes, the cats are fed twice a day, in the morning and the evening. They get wet food and dry food.
How many cats now?
We have 8 cats now. At one time we had 14.
Right, okay.
And so through just life, we so that's one thing I do every day for sure, is feed the cats. And at the same time every day, so they gather, waiting for me to come out the door. I check the email, I check the stats to the website. Urban Dharma now, the website gets 1 million hits a month, which is pretty good. And my podcasts are downloaded over 100,000 times a month. So I'm there looking at the stats to see what page is most interesting, what country has found Urban Dharma and is getting into the pages that I've created. So my website now is 2,600 pages big. Started in 2001. So that's something that's sort of a daily activity as well. And then I answer the phone and I get invited to do all sorts of things. So I was invited to do this interview. Sunday I'll be speaking at a Unitarian church in Studio City. Last Thursday I gave a talk at an 8th grade graduation. And just it just keeps happening in this sort of normal, fascinating way that my life is filled with so much to do, and it's always unique and most of the time challenging. What am I going to do? How am I going to say it? What am I going to say? So it keeps me very engaged in life and in me.
And when you go out and give presentations, you record them habitually and use those as your podcast?
Yes. You know, I know this is, if you go to my podcast page, which is on iTunes, Urban Dharma, or on my website, mypodcast.net, what you'll find is there's like a 6 or 7 year lag between my first podcast and the podcast I'm now producing. And the reason there's that big lag in there is I thought I had said everything I needed to say, but people kept saying, you know, we really like your podcast. Can you post some more, post some more? So generally speaking, what I'll do is I'll take my little digital recorder with me and I'll place it somewhere and I'll record it and then I'll post it as a podcast.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we're out of time here. This was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And could you say what your magazine is just quickly?
Sure. It's Speak Up Magazine and it's in Italy.
Okay.
And it's for people who use English as a second language.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, thanks. Thanks for coming by
today.
Thank
you so much. It's a pleasure.